This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. You know, it's always gratifying to know we have listeners who take action on some of the topics we cover here on the program. This week, we received a call from someone who had heard me mention life insurance in a recent program. Well, he started contacting local life insurance brokers to purchase some insurance. He didn't tell us exactly what he needed, but apparently he's looking for insurance. The only problem is when he called to get advice, he got different brokers with so much conflicting information, he almost came away completely bewildered as to what he should do. So even though we sell life insurance at PFS Group, we're really not able to provide specific advice here on a particular product or how much an investor should buy. But we thought many of you out there might appreciate some kind of guidance as to when you should consider life insurance, if you need it, what type you may want to buy, and what level of coverage do you ultimately need. So those are some of the topics we're going to cover here on Lifetime Income this week.
And I'm Kathleen Harris. Coming up later on in the program, Jim will be talking to Gary Thomas, who's the current president of the National Association of Realtors, talking about real estate again. Many of you have called us and asked us, is it time to buy? Should I buy a rental home, primary property? Should I be in? Should I be out with interest rates changing? So this is some of the stuff that Jim will be talking with Mr. Thomas about later on in the program today.
As we said, this is going to be a program about life insurance. So let's get started.
Jim, I think the question that people would probably ask us first is, do I even need life insurance? Right? That's the first question they would probably ask us. I know that most people start to think about this question maybe when they get married or they have their first child. All of a sudden, this idea of providing for the family becomes, you know, an issue they start to think about. That's not to say that single people shouldn't have life insurance as well, though. Just as an aside, since I'm a singleton, I can speak to this. Sometimes as a singleton, it's a good idea to have life insurance to cover unexpected costs or debt that you might have, because some states would require your families to pick up that tab for you. You don't really want to have your parents and siblings paying for that for you. But basically, life insurance in most cases is pretty attractive because, for the most part, life insurance benefits are not taxable. Well, at least not under current tax law, which, as we know, Jim, is constantly changing.
And Kathleen, whether you really need life insurance, once again, really depends on your situation. Most people, when they get married, as you just mentioned, they're starting out in life. Maybe they bought their first house. They're just starting a family. And they really don't have a lot of assets to take care of the surviving spouse or the kids in the family because they're just starting out in life. And unless they came from a large inheritance, maybe they inherited something, most people start out in life with basically nothing. They start scraping together savings. Maybe the first important thing is to get enough money for a down payment on the house. Then as life proceeds, they start a family. So like so many other things we talk about, whether it's investing, retirement planning, you really have to begin with the end in mind. So first of all, you need to outline for yourself what you think you'd like your life insurance to do. In other words, what do you want this for? And how much you need really depends on the end. What are you trying to cover? What are you trying to provide for? There are a lot of online life insurance evaluator tools that are doing what we call in the business needs analysis. And it really begins with some basic questions. Number one, who do you want your life insurance to benefit? Your kids, your spouse, an institution, your parents, a friend? And it's not just who do you want to benefit from this life insurance, and especially if you're starting out young. And let's face it, with low interest rates today, it takes millions of dollars to take care of bringing some kind of income. And you want to be able to protect your spouse. We've talked about spousal abuse so often here on the program. So you might want to consider a life insurance trust so that if something happens to you, The life insurance proceeds are paid into a trust, and it's held there to protect your wife and your children from somebody taking advantage of them financially, because we see this happen quite often. So, first of all, who do you want to benefit from your life insurance? A second question that's really important when it comes to determining life insurance needs. Number one, let's say, for example, do you want to cover your mortgage? Maybe you bought a house. You would like your surviving spouse to be debt-free. Two, in addition to covering a significant debt, you may want to consider 1 to 3 years of living expense for your family. Today, Kathleen, I think we see a lot of young couples today where both the husband and the wife works. But after losing one spouse, there is a recovery period. So you may want to consider not only maybe paying off the mortgage, but also providing sort of a cushion, a kitty, 2 or 3 years worth of living expenses. Another factor might be education. Maybe you have 2 or 3 children and you're saying, boy, if something happened to me, you know, we're putting money aside for their education, but we don't have enough yet. I'd like to have my children attend a college. So you might want to factor in education cost, burial expenses, and other reasons for owning life insurance, especially if you have a larger estate, a family business, maybe a large real estate holdings, or you're fortunate enough to be beyond the current exemption of $5.25 million, which would be $10.5 million for a husband and wife to pay for estate taxes. Or we use it a lot sometimes in businesses where you have 2 or 3 partners. It's usually called key man insurance. And what you try to do is have life insurance taken out on the partner's lives so that if one partner passes away, you have enough money to buy out that partner's estate and carry on the business. So there's all kinds of multiple reasons. And when you do envision the need for life insurance ending, because, you know, maybe you're starting out life and you're thinking, okay, I need to cover the mortgage, provide for education, put aside some money for a kitty. There's not that money there. But what happens if 10, 20, 30 years go by? Now you've accumulated assets. You may have inherited assets from either side of the spouse's parents. But anyway, the need goes away as you replace the insurance with actual savings and investment. So this is related to getting back to that needs analysis. When you're buying insurance, it's based on a need. If that need or objective has been met, then you have to evaluate whether you still need that insurance. For example, if your main reason for purchasing life insurance is to cover the remaining mortgage on your home so your family will have a place to live, your coverage may end when your mortgage balance drops down substantially. Maybe you make extra payments on that mortgage, you switch over to a 15-year mortgage, or there's little balance left. And so when you look at insurance, first question is who? Who do you want to benefit? What? What do you want covered? And when, in terms of time frame? All of these have to be factored in for reasons for life insurance, and that's really what's going to drive the type of insurance you may want and also consider purchasing.
Jim, you mentioned something about when do you envision the need for the insurance having an end? And I think this is something that's kind of new for people. When you talk about life insurance, what? There's life insurance that has an end date? Well, there's actually basically two different types of life insurance. There's term insurance, which, like the name implies, only lasts for a specific term or specific period of time. Maybe that period of time is 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. Again, something to think about if your main goal is to leave your spouse debt-free when you pass away. Maybe you think that in 20 years you'll have enough saved through other assets that you won't need to have that life insurance cushion anymore, so you pick up a 20-year term policy. And then the second basic type of life insurance coverage is coverage that ends with the date of death. And there's 3 basic types of this kind of insurance. One is whole life insurance. Another is universal life insurance, and the third is variable universal life insurance. So let's just start with term insurance. So like we talked about, term insurance only lasts for a specific period of time and usually has a fixed payment. Term policies don't have a cash value like other types of policies do, so that's something to definitely think about. So you can't take a loan out against this policy, and once you've made a premium payment, you don't get that payment back. So term insurance, Jim, when would I start thinking about using term insurance, or when would be some good scenarios where term insurance might be a good option for me?
You know, Kathleen, term insurance really fits people that are starting out, let's say a young couple getting married, or you're in a situation, you've got a mortgage, you have kids, and you want them to have an education, you want the mortgage to be covered. Really what you're trying to do is buy as much insurance as you can to take care of all of those needs, and you don't want to expend a lot of money for hefty insurance premiums because you have, quite honestly, other things going on in your life. You may be saving for a college education. You may be saving for weddings. You're salting away money in your company or work 401k plan or 403b plan or, you know, the 451 plans of government. So you really want to buy the maximum amount of protection for the least amount. Now, I like term insurance because you buy a lot of insurance and that's really all you care about. You know, I don't like using whole life insurance for couples starting out as a savings account. I think 401k programs with matching contributions from the employer are much more effective. However, term insurance goes up every single year. And you run a risk there that if you develop some kind of unexpected health problem. So what I usually like is to lock in a premium and do something like a 10-year certain policy where the premium is locked in for 10 years. You're going to pay a little bit more than, let's say, a term insurance that renews every single year where the insurance company can raise it. But I don't like that. It's too much risk for health reasons. And I also like 20-year level term. And when I say level term, 10-year level term, 20-year level term, what I'm saying here is the premium remains the same for whatever period you choose, 10 years, 20 years. For a young couple starting out, I like a 10 to 20-year term because you've locked in a low rate. It's constant. You know exactly what it's going to be. It's not going to be going up each year. And more importantly, should unexpectedly you get in an accident, you become disabled, or, you know, you get in a car accident or develop a serious illness, if you have just renewable term, then the insurance company can increase that premium. So I like a level term policy, 10 to 20 years, Kathleen, for somebody that is starting out in life. Now, the other kinds of insurance, universal life insurance, whole life insurance, I like to use those for specific situations. I mainly use those when it comes to, for example, business planning, when there's partners involved, key man insurance, where the business may want to have access to the cash value. They may need to borrow out of the policy for whatever reason. I also like it to use it to cover estate taxes. But in order to cover estate taxes, then we use it in a different way. The individual insured cannot own the insurance when it comes for estate taxes, otherwise it'll be included in their estate. So we usually set up a wealth replacement trust or some other kind of vehicle so that we keep not only the proceeds income tax free, which is how insurance is taxed. There are no income taxes when you receive the benefits of a policy, but also estate taxes. So there are a lot of different kinds of insurance depending on the needs, but I would say I use whole life more for business insurance, more for estate tax insurance, because you really don't want a level term policy if you're in your 60s and 70s and you're using it to cover estate taxes, because what happens if you live to your late 80s and 90s? And that's why I don't think it fits there. Variable life insurance or universal life insurance was very popular, but the only problem, Kathleen, is it wasn't guaranteed. In other words, if the returns on the policy or the insurance company fell short, the insurance company could always go back to the insured and ask for additional premiums or higher premiums as you age. So the universal policies, I think, carry a lot more risk. The risk of living longer and the risk of returns in the market are on the insured, and I don't think most people like that.
You've been sort of tossing around a lot of these different terms, whole life and universal life and variable universal life. Why don't we sort of delve a little bit deeper into what these terms, these types of insurance actually mean? So starting off with whole life. So whole life insurance is a lifetime insurance, and it protects you as long as you keep making your premium payments. And you can either do an upfront single payment, which is pretty significantly sized, or you can do a periodic payment for your insurance, semi-annual, annual, monthly, what have you. One thing about whole life insurance as compared to term insurance, whole life insurance does have what we call a cash value, which means that if you need to withdraw money from your policy or take a loan out against your policy, you can. Now, it may have tax implications. You may be paying some penalties and fees to do that. But whole life insurance does come with that perk that there is a cash value to the policy. And the cash value increases over time with each premium payment that you make. And you pretty much know how much your cash value is going to increase with every premium payment that you make. That's part of your policy contract. So you've talked a little bit about this whole life policy situation, and there's several different types of whole life policy. There's single premium payments, there's lifetime payments, there's limited premium payments. What situations would suit those different types of whole life insurance, Jim?
As we were talking previously, Kathleen, I like to use whole life when it comes to a business where it builds up a cash value. There's some deductibility there. The business may have needs to access that cash in the future, for example. And I also like to use it when it comes to estate planning because you know exactly what your premiums are. They don't change. They're going to remain that way. And so I use it in estate planning. You know, whether you want to use a single premium, you have to be careful because there are gifts. A husband and wife can give $14,000 or $28,000 per beneficiary. So let's just round that off to $30,000 for illustration purposes. Let's say that there are three kids on the policy and there are hefty estate taxes to pay for either the business or the real estate holdings. Technically, you could give up to $90,000 a year on those insurance premiums without filing a gift tax return. Now, some people don't like to do that. They like to say, you know what? I'm just going to take the lump sum. I don't want to be burdened by the payments. The only problem with that is if you had, in this case, let's say three beneficiaries, you would only be able to give $90,000. Anything over that, you would have to use part of that $5.25 million gifting provision and you'd use it up. So I usually don't like to do that because if you're using that exemption or taking and subtracting that exemption, then that means there's more of your estate that's going to be taxable. So I usually like to use the gifting allowance where you don't have to file a gift tax return and you don't have to pay any gift taxes. And that's where I like to use whole life insurance, Kathleen, usually for younger couples and for something that is only a temporary need, a timeline like starting out 10 years, 20 years, I'm going to use term insurance, and especially for younger couples starting out where the insurance costs are very, very cheap. But you start getting into your 50s and 60s, and especially in your 60s and 70s, the cost of insurance gets quite expensive.
I want to go back to something you mentioned, Jim. You mentioned about using the gifting exemption for life insurance. Just to be clear, were you referring to if you were a parent who wanted to leave your kids an inheritance and you chose to do it by essentially funding a life insurance policy for them? And so you were using your annual gift exemption of $14,000 a year to make that annual premium payment for a life insurance policy for your kids? Is that what you were talking about when you're talking about the annual gift exemption for funding this whole life policy?
Exactly, because a husband can give $14,000 to a child, the wife can give $14,000, so between the husband and wife, they can give each child $28,000 without having to file a gift tax return or use up any of that estate tax exclusion, that $5.25 million figure.
Got it. I just wanted to make sure we were all clear about what that gift tax exemption was being used for. We talked a little bit about whole life versus universal life. I think it might be helpful if we sort of unpack a little bit the differences between those two different types of policies. I know that whole life insurance's cash value basically accrues at a predictable rate that's in part of your policy agreement. Universal life is a little bit different than that. It also has a cash value, but as you were mentioning, Jim, that cash value is somewhat tied to circumstances outside your control. In the case of universal life insurance, it's tied to interest rates, and your policy might have a certain guaranteed minimum interest rate it's going to return to you every year. But again, right now interest rates are super low. Maybe the policies you're being offered right now are super low interest rates. Again, you don't really have any control over how much that policy's cash value is growing year over year. Has some of the nice same features as whole life insurance, right though, Jim?
It does, because you're building up a cash value, and usually when you take out a policy, the agent is going to give you two columns that it's very important that you look at when they're presented to you. One is called the guaranteed minimum rate, and it shows you when the policy runs out, when they can raise it. And the other one is a projected value, and that projected value is based on all these wonderful things remaining in place. And one of the problems that we've seen, Kathleen, over probably the last decade, when Greenspan brought interest rates down after the 2001 recession and the bursting of the tech bubble, a lot of these universal policies required more premium payments and more cash injections from their policyholders because those projected values and interest rates didn't hold up. And the same thing happened right after the financial crisis of 2007 and 2009. I mean, just take a look at where interest rates are today and the projections that were made 5 years ago. I mean, 5 years ago, you could have got 5% on a two-year treasury note. Today, Kathleen, you can only get 0.3%. So, you know, if an insurance company was basing their projections and their premium payments based on their forecast of a projected return, the problem is the markets have changed. I mean, just take a look at what's happened to interest rates over the last 5 years, where we've got down to the lowest interest rate. So the problem with universal, whether you're taking variable universal, where you're investing in the stock market, the bond market, international funds, or you're just simply interest rate oriented, the investment risk of falling short of the stated rate of return lies with the insured, not with the insurance company. And I don't like that because that creates too much uncertainty. And it's sold, oh, you don't need to worry about that. We've had a track record. Well, folks, we're in different times right now. And what happens is invariably when returns don't come out the way they're projected, then the insurance company is coming back to you and say, well, there's some cash value here. We can use that cash value. But if we do that, we're going to run the policy down. And then we're going to have to ask you for more cash injections. And it creates a lot more uncertainty. And I think when you're really looking at life insurance, you want certainty. You want to know what the death benefit is, number one. You want to know that that's not going to change. It's going to be there. Number two, you always want to know what that premium payment is. It's kind of like a margin call, Kathleen. If the returns don't turn out the way they're projected, the last thing you want is your insurance agent calling you up and saying, remember that policy we took out 5 years ago? Well, unfortunately, we need to raise the premiums because the returns aren't where we expected them to be. So they're going to ask you either for another cash injection into the policy or they're going to bump up the premiums. And it's creating two elements of uncertainty, both on the death benefit and on the premiums. And when it comes to insurance, you want certainty. You don't want guesswork. You don't want maybes. You don't want to sit in the back of your mind, well, I wonder how long this thing holds up. So that's why in this current investment environment, I'm really not in favor of universal life insurance.
Well, you sort of touched very briefly on a very specific type of universal life insurance, Jim, which is variable universal life. Generally speaking, universal life insurance is tied more to interest rates, but variable universal life is actually tied to the markets because you essentially agree to invest your cash value in the policy into sort of underlying investments that are in the market that are managed by the insurance company. They're not publicly traded. They're only available to policyholders. And so you're essentially basing your cash value of your policy and to some extent your death benefit value as well on the performance of these underlying investment vehicles in your policy. Good when the market's going up, not so good when the market's going down. Is there a place for a variable universal life policy, Jim, in this type of market situation?
I would say there is some room for that. I mean, if you have a good investment advisor who's done well by you with your investments, well, if he's made you money in the market by managing your mutual funds, then maybe there's a fit there. Because after all, the market's up 18% this year so far. It was up 14% last year. So people that have variable life insurance policies have built up quite a substantial cash value because of the returns in the market. But Kathleen, those returns won't always be there. And what you don't want to do is build up this cash value because the market's going up and all of a sudden you go through a 2007 and 2009. So if you're going to be in a variable life insurance policy, asset allocation, market monitoring strategies are essential to maintain this policy because it's not a set and forget type of policy. They have to be monitored with the vagaries of the stock market and the bond market.
I wanted to ask you about something else too, Jim. We've had a couple of people call us and ask us about this whole idea of taking out a loan against your life insurance policy at a really low interest rate as being sort of an investment strategy to then take those monies and invest them elsewhere or to use them to finance other things. What do you think about that idea as far as taking a loan out against your life insurance policy at a low interest rate to do some of these other things?
I don't like the concept because you're defeating what you bought that insurance or what that cash value is there. What happens, Kathleen, if you took money out? I mean, we saw this happen in the 90s, and then we got the bursting of the tech bubble. We saw it happen in the last decade as people were taking money out of life insurance, using it to buy rental properties, and then we had the housing bust, the financial crisis. So unless you're a very astute investor, you're good on market timing, you have good risk controls, you're investing in something liquid that you can get out of, unless you have those attributes as an investor, I don't like it.
I know that we've talked about this a couple times here in the firm, that borrowing to invest is really generally not a good idea. Too much risk of loss.
Yeah, it's just too much risk. And I mean, how many people would love to get a margin call? I mean, I can think of nothing more frightening when you wake up one day, as many gold investors or tech investors in the last decade, or investors in general in 2007 and 2008 or 2009. I mean, you just don't want to put that risk on yourself unless you're a very astute investor. You're good at market timing. You're good at risk control. You understand technical analysis, macroeconomics, how things can change. And Kathleen, you just don't run into too many people that have those qualities. I would say the majority of people that are buying a life insurance policy are buying it because they want certainty. They want to cover a certain risk or provide for a spouse or children or to cover estate taxes or to be able to buy out a partner. And they want those steady premiums. They don't want to get a call from the broker saying you need to come up with more money or your policy is going to lapse. You know, we're going to have to raise your premiums. I just don't like that. I think you're defeating the purpose of insurance in general.
This is a really great point because I think it brings us circling back to the reason where we started out with, which is basically before you purchase an insurance contract or insurance policy, you need to really figure out the basics of the contract. Like, number one, how long do you think the coverage might need to last? Is your need for the insurance only going to be maybe a 10-year or a 20-year or a 30-year need? Or is it going to be something that lasts your entire lifetime? Number two, will you need to ever make use of a cash value of a policy? If so, you need to be able to have a policy that allows for cash withdrawals, and you need to understand any sort of fees associated with that, any sort of withdrawal penalties associated with that. But something to analyze is, am I going to need to have some sort of cash value available to me if I buy a policy? The third thing is, are there other fees and charges associated with the policy? Why are they there? How are they calculated? How often am I paying them? Because sometimes those hidden fees can really start to eat away at the cash value of your policy. Number four, are flexible payments an option? Is that a good thing or a bad thing for you? Something to think about. Especially as Jim was saying, that there are situations in which, if especially with universal life insurance, things don't perform as well and you get that call back from your insurance broker saying, hey, you know, what's being made on your policy isn't enough to cover your premium payments anymore. You need to cough up more cash. Could be a bad thing for you. Number five, which we haven't really talked a whole lot about here, Jim, is that most life insurance policies come with a plethora of possible riders. And probably the most common one that you and I talk about or have dealt with would be some kind of long-term care policy rider. So just, you know, as you're talking about insurance with your broker, you might want to explore some of the policy riders available to you.
And so, Kathleen, as we sort of sum up here, I think not everyone needs life insurance, but some people do. I mean, quite honestly, most couples starting out, unless they have an inheritance or were savers getting married later in life, we've talked a lot recently about small businesses where certain types of life insurance can be an important part of the business owner's estate plan. We've mentioned that James Gandolfini's estate would have benefited immensely from an estate plan that would have included life insurance to cover the estate taxes. So there's all kinds of situations, like families with one income, high debt. They may need to think about life insurance as a way for a family to maintain its lifestyle if something happens to the breadwinner or something happens unexpectedly, as we see with the actor from The Sopranos. I mean, who would have thought at age 51 dying of a heart attack? But, you know, we see it more and more.
Well, Jim, there you have it. We've talked about all the basics of life insurance. We've talked about term life insurance, whole life insurance, universal life insurance, variable universal life insurance. And it may be that one or maybe more of these types of insurance might fit your situation. I know people are going to ask us, how do I even know where to start in terms of, do I need to have insurance? Well, there's a lot of really great online tools out there that will help you determine if you need to go ahead and research this a little bit more. For example, Bankrate.com has a pretty good evaluation tool. Nearly any major insurance company out there that you see ads for on TV is going to have some kind of life insurance evaluator tool on their website. MSN Money has one on their website. Nearly any financial website out there is going to have some kind of life insurance evaluator tool. Now, I wouldn't take that as gospel in terms of whether or not you actually need life insurance, but it might help you pinpoint, do I need it at all, and roughly what amount am I supposed to be talking about? And like we always say, this is a big financial decision, so before you pick up any policies or buy anything, make sure you do some research, talk to a reputable financial advisor, maybe more than one, to get comparisons as far as what you should do. But again, whatever you do, just make sure that you talk with someone who's reputable and licensed about your options in terms of life insurance before putting your money down on anything.
And for our next segment of the program, we're going to talk about real estate again, where it's hot, where it's not. Is it time to buy? Should you rent? Coming up, I'm going to speak with Gary Thomas. He's the current president of the National Association of Realtors, coming up right after this. Joining me as my special guest on the program today is Gary Thomas. He's president of the National Association of Realtors. Well, Gary, I would have to say that most homeowners in this country are finally breathing a sigh of relief. Real estate prices have gone up. I'd like to get your take on that from the National Association of Realtors. Is this something specific to certain regions of the country, or would you say this is pretty much universal across the country?
Well, I think in most areas it's the case. There are a few areas within the country where they haven't started to lift as much, and some areas that obviously have had quite an increase in prices. But in general, across the country, prices are up.
Now, Gary, what does this mean for places like California where, you know, even though prices have come down and they're starting to go up again, the cost of living for most homes here is pretty high. I mean, whether you take a look at San Diego and work your way north up to where you're at, all the way up to San Francisco, I mean, prices for homes are pretty hefty. And now we've had mortgage rates rise. Have you seen any pullback, let's say, in the California region as a result of these two factors?
We've actually seen a little bit of a pullback, but I'm not sure it's because of all of those factors. I think probably the biggest thing is we don't have hardly any inventory in the short sale or foreclosure market. So it's all regular sellers predominantly in the market. And unfortunately, because the prices have started to rise, a lot of the sellers are a little greedy. So they are pricing their homes too high, and that has restricted the market because the buyers are saying, no, I don't think so. So we're starting to see some price reductions, which will bring things more into line.
Gary, I have heard this from other individuals in the real estate business. They're telling me that there is, in fact, our local newspapers here ran a story about the lack of inventory of new housing. Is it because, let's say, the builders are being a little bit more cautious? I know some of the housing developments here locally with Lennar and some of the bigger builders, you're just not seeing the big releases in phases. Lennar just started a project. They're only releasing 5 homes at a time. If I went back 5 or 6 years ago, they were releasing 10 and 20 homes.
Yeah, I think they're just being a lot more cautious in what they're releasing. And so, you know, the large builders, of course, have the capital to do it and could release more. But I think they're just being cautious and want to make sure that whatever they put out there is sold. And so far, that's what's happening. So I think you'll start to see them increase the number of houses that they actually release onto the market.
So in other words, when they get a little more confidence that this is really sustainable, they might get a little bit more aggressive in terms of how many homes they build. I mean, what we're seeing in our area for the first time in, gosh, almost 5 years, custom homes are now starting to be built. In our neighborhood, a builder is building 2 custom spec homes. I haven't seen that, Gary, for probably 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, at least 6 or 7 years. You're absolutely right. But we are starting to see it. Even the upper end is starting to move very, very well. And so you're going to see that more and more. You're going to see the custom home construction. I'm actually working on a project now that will have 10 custom lots. And, you know, the developer feels like those will go rather quickly.
Gary, I know in our area, the realtors tell me that if the homes in the 1, 2, to $3 million are what's moving with a lot of these projects. But the upper end homes, like let's say in California in La Jolla, or let's say Rancho Santa Fe, the upper end homes have not moved as much as we've seen on the lower end. What do you think are the reasons for that?
Well, I think those that are in the very upper end category, the buyers, are just being very cautious because, you know, a swing of 10 or 20%, you know, going down is a hefty number when you get up into those price ranges. So I think that's a lot of it. They're just being more cautious than they used to be.
Is there a sort of a sequence when these turnarounds happen? I mean, we saw it with institutions coming in like hedge funds buying large swaths of land like in real estate in Phoenix. And it starts at the lower end and works its way up. Is the upper end the last to finally get a liftoff?
Typically it is, although sometimes you'll see the very lower end get a lift, which is very, very normal, and the bottom of the middle will, and then sometimes the very top will. It's typically that upper middle is the slower one to respond, although this time it hasn't been that way.
Maybe it's because towards the top end, a lot of those people got hit in the equity markets in the downturn. These are people that tend to have large portfolios. I want to talk about the affordability index because it's been at the highest level that we've seen in some time, a combination of low interest rates and dropping and falling housing prices. Now, that has ticked down here with the jump in mortgage rates, but let's talk about affordability. I know with my own kids, my youngest son was looking and they're finding it cheaper to buy than it is to rent because their rents just kept going up. The last rent increase was over 10%.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It's interesting that you say that because my daughter just purchased in the spring, same reason. Her mortgage, including taxes, insurance, and everything, is less than it was to rent. So it made a whole lot of sense.
So are you seeing, when we talk about the real estate market taking off, from your perspective, where are the buyers coming from? Are they people that are trading up? Are they first-time home buyers? Are they maybe a combination of both?
It is, but we also had an awful lot of investor buyers. 30% of the market was all cash with investors. And so
Wow. That
made a huge difference in the market, too. You know, the hardest hit really in trying to get into homes right now is first-time home buyer because they have been going after the lower end of the market where there's been a lot of activity with investors and cash. And so they're facing multiple offers and probably have to make offers on several homes before they finally get one.
I want to put this in perspective for, let's say, our listeners that are getting ready to retire, because, Gary, one of the largest assets owned by most Americans, I don't need to tell you this, is their home. And for the longest time, people that were getting close to retirement, you know, the kids have grown up, they've put them through school, they're off, they're married. So they're empty nesters, they're heading towards retirement. And typically, you would see a lot of couples would either downsize, sell the home, go into, let's say, a retirement community, or even buy a smaller home. Let's talk about the practicalities of that.
Well, I think you're going to see more and more of that as, you know, the boomers get of an age where they're retiring and they don't need the big house anymore. You're absolutely right. My wife and I went through the same thing. We didn't need the large home anymore when the kids were gone. And so downsizing made a whole lot of sense. Plus, a lot of retirees want to get into a single story because as they age, they don't move around as easily and it's much easier to be in a single story home. So I think you're going to see more and more of that. Single story, smaller homes are going to have a premium attached to them because of that. But you're also going to see a lot of them go into the retirement communities where the majority of the homes are single story. Then you're also going to see them go into condominiums too.
And when you see that happening, what is this going to do for the market? Because if you take a look at the demographics, the baby boomer population is probably one of the largest segments in our society and the largest segment heading into retirement. So as the boomers start unloading, let's say their larger homes, and then start looking for, as you say, let's say if you had a two-story home when the kids we're living with you. Now you're getting older. You'd like to get a single story, something smaller. Is that going to change some of the pricing dynamics of the market? In other words, as you just mentioned, there's a big demand for single-story homes. And that's interesting that you say that, Gary, because I've been noticing in our neighborhood that a lot of the new custom homes that are being built, they're not two-story, they're single-story.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I think that's exactly what you're going to see. You're going to see people paying a premium to get into that lifestyle because there's going to be such a demand for it. So I think you're going to see the builders more and more offer single-story homes, and a lot of them offering smaller single-story. The average person that's retiring or moving down, so to speak, doesn't want to go back into a 4,000-square-foot home. Even if it is a single-story, it's still a lot to maintain.
Yeah, that's interesting because I was looking at some demographic trends and real estate trends. You know, over the years, if you look at decade after decade, the size of the home kept expanding. I can remember when the living room functioned more like the family room. Then we added the family room, we added the study, the den, the media room, and all these different rooms and homes expanded in size. We went from carports to two-car garages, heck, to four- and five-car garages. So do you think the trend we're more likely to see because of this aging demographic is going to be smaller homes, maybe a two-car garage at best? And like you said, if you're downsizing from 4,000 feet or five in a two-story, you're probably less likely to want to buy a 3,000 or 3,500-square-foot home.
Right. That's exactly right. And I mean, I think you're going to see people willing to go down into 2,000 to 2,500 feet. You know, once you get just to a couple living in the home anymore, and occasionally maybe they have somebody that comes over and maybe you need that third bedroom. But typically most people, when it's just the two of them, can actually live pretty nicely in a two-bedroom house. It doesn't even necessarily have to be a three. There's a new community just being built in South Orange County that has a whole retirement area in it. And if I remember right, there's five or six different tracks being built in it, and it's all senior living. They're all single story, and they range anywhere from about 1,500 square feet up to 3,000 in the different communities in there. And I have to tell you, it's been swamped with people.
That brings up a question, because I have some clients right now that are downsizing and they're looking for homes. Unless you go into a senior community where you might have, let's say, a two-bedroom home, maybe in the 1,500 to 1,800 square feet, you know, a master bedroom and that extra room for guests that come visiting or maybe the kids, are you going to see the demand for, let's say, a three-bedroom home or, let's say, a two-bedroom with a little office or den? In other words, homes that are designed specifically for seniors, because a lot of homes are designed with three and four bedrooms for resale purposes, you know, for families. If you got a family looking for a home and you have a couple kids, you're going to want a three or four bedroom home. Are they doing anything innovative on the senior side with, you know, maybe two bedrooms, a den to accommodate, let's say, boomers that are downsizing?
Absolutely. In this particular community I was speaking about, that's exactly what they've done. And they've gone with, instead of having a living room, dining room, family room, they've gone with a great room. And typically it opens even into the kitchen. And so it's a much more livable floor plan for seniors who don't need that much space, but it still has two bedrooms or two bedrooms and a study. So it fits the lifestyle that most people want to get to when they're retiring or getting up there. And maybe they're not retiring, but they just don't need the amount of space that they needed before because they're getting closer to retirement age.
Gary, let's talk about the concept of the reverse mortgage. You see so many commercials when you watch the evening news today as a kind of panacea for people that are maybe strapped for cash. I have found some problems with them. If people get a lump sum and they spend it for a medical emergency, then they could find themselves in trouble. What's your view on reverse mortgages?
I think you have to be very, very cautious of reverse mortgages. You only have to look at the problems that FHA has had most recently in their portfolio. And the biggest problem area they have is in the reverse mortgage area. That's where they have the biggest delinquencies and the most problem loans. Had they not gone into the reverse mortgage business, their portfolio would be pristine right now. It'd be much more like what the VA portfolio is. And so I think that only gives you a glimpse of the problems that are inherent in the reverse mortgage. Not to say that for some people it may be the right thing if they manage it properly.
Has the problem been, Gary, maybe people get strapped for cash, there's a medical emergency or something, so, you know, taking some of that equity in a lump sum and being able to live in the home, but, you know, they still, if they're having cash flow problems or additional problems, they're still required to make the insurance payments, the property taxes, the maintenance on the home. Is that where they're running into problems?
I believe it is. I think either they used it for medical emergencies or they thought they would be very wise in making other investments back when the boom days were there. So I think, again, it's problematic in that it can get them into trouble. But at the same time, it may be their only way of taking care of medical emergencies. So kind of a double-edged sword. Again, somebody needs to be really well coached on it so that they understand what they're getting into, what the ramifications are, and fully understand it.
In your view, are we going to see more of a trend? We were talking earlier about this new community that's going up, that they're having a section for seniors that's going to be more designed for people heading into retirement. I would suspect that is going to be one of the new trends. I know here we're also seeing some of the new homes that are going up are much, much smaller in comparison to, let's say, the go-go boom years of the last decade, where it was kind of like, I call it the race to build a McMansion.
Yeah, I agree with you. And you're really not seeing that now. What you're seeing is smaller, better designed livability homes for active people that have come to the decision they don't need huge and they don't need the number of rooms that you once thought you needed. So I think the McMansion days, they're not completely gone, but I don't think there's going to be a race to see who builds the biggest anymore.
So overall, your recommendation, what would you advise somebody that is, let's say, thinking of putting their house up for sale, they're thinking of downsizing? Would you advise them to look for these newer type communities?
Well, I think the first thing they should do is consult with a realtor and a financial planner to make sure that, you know, the decisions they're making are sound. And, you know, the realtor will help them in analyzing what their own home is truly worth, and at the same time, help them with knowing what the availability of product is, both on the resale market as well as the new. And so a good realtor will show all of those things to them. And then a financial planner or a CPA go over it and make sure that this really makes sense for them in their retirement years.
Well, Gary, if our listeners would like to get more information about whether it's a new home community or about more information about real estate, what information is available through the National Association of Realtors?
Well, you know, if you're wanting to start looking at homes or getting an idea maybe of what yours is worth, you can go to Realtor.com. And Realtor.com will show you all of the properties available, and we'll very soon have all the new home communities on there too. So that's a good resource. You can also go to Realtor.org, and there is plenty of information there, as well as other sites that we can point you to from Realtor.org. So I think you're going to see plenty of information for any home buyer or home seller.
Well, listen, Gary, thanks so much for joining us on the program. And at least it seems like the demographic trends are moving in the right direction and home builders are picking up on that trend. Sounds like we may see some innovation in this area.
That would sure be nice. And it does look like that's happened. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to share with you.
Well, you have yourself a great day. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you. Bye now.
Well, that ends our interview with Gary Thomas at the National Association of Realtors. It was interesting. He was pointing to a trend there that we're starting to see, where as the baby boomers head into retirement, they're downsizing, but they're looking for special kind of homes. Maybe their last home, they had a den, a study, or maybe they have part-time hobbies. So they're looking for something beyond the two-bedroom home that you find in so many adult living communities. And it sounds like builders are responding with that. As he mentioned, a whole new community up in Irvine, and we're hearing more and more interest locally here in San Diego for the same kind of product. So rather interesting that when there's a demand, smart entrepreneurs respond to that demand. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we speak again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.